Today is Sunday, March 7, 2021. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. Good to hear from you.
You too. Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you certainly may.
Thank you. Jim, last time you had gotten us up to late 1978, fall of 78, December, and then into January of 79. Can you pick that thread up again?
Sure, yeah. So, about this time, of course, I was working towards my undergraduate degree in geology at Tucson, University of Arizona, down there. But, I was taking trips whenever I could get away from classes up to the canyon and other places. But primarily my destination was the canyon, you know, doing hikes, shorter hikes and whatnot. By early 79, it was pretty obvious that to me that I was going to likely be going to graduate school, because I'd gotten so hooked on geology, and in particular paleontology, which is the study, of course, of fossil organisms. And so I put out applications to go to grad schools in various places. While those were kind of percolating, because you send them in at that time, you would send them in like in January, and you wouldn't know until later in the spring.
Okay.
If you got in or not. So I had, while that was percolating, I worked out a deal with, not a deal, but a plan with Larry Treiber. I mentioned Larry earlier, who was the proprietor of Desert Mountain Sports in Phoenix, and Bruce Grubbs, who was the proprietor of Alpineer, I guess it was, in Flagstaff. And a friend of Larry's named Dennis Abing, who climbed a lot with Larry down in the Phoenix area.
Hey, Jim.
And Larry and Dennis.
Hey, Jim.
Excuse me?
How do you spell Larry and Bruce and Dennis's last names?
Oh, sure. So Larry Treiber was T-R-E-I-B-E-R.
Thank you.
And Bruce Grubbs is G-R-U-B-B-S. And then Dennis Abing was A-B-B-I-N-K. So
how did Dennis get into the equation?
Yeah, Dennis, I knew Dennis from just hanging out with him in the climbing shop in Phoenix, you know, Desert Mountain Sports. I met him there on various occasions, and guys would get together in the climbing shop and just shoot the bull, right? And
okay.
Talk about routes and you know, objectives and plans and things. And so I knew that Larry and Dennis were climbing a lot in central Arizona at a fairly high level of climbing, you know, like 5'10" climbing at the time was pretty,
wow.
Pretty, you know, high level. We hatched a plan to try and do Quaggint. And of course, Bruce and I had been in there a year prior, I guess, and seen Quaggint from fairly close and just south of it. And we realized it was going to be a big climb, at least for us. I know people just run up these things nowadays, but without knowing the route, you know, without having any idea of the gear that would be required, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a fairly substantial. We figured it was going to be a fairly substantial undertaking. And so we planned to do this in March when the weather was still cool, and which necessitated an entry point from Saddle Canyon, right, from the north. So we drove into House Rock Valley, and in fact, Bruce, if my recollection was right, was at a trade show in Vegas.
Hmm.
And so Dennis and Larry and I drove in from the south, from Phoenix, and went into House Rock Valley. And I remember we were driving into House Rock Valley in the middle. It was late at night. It was certainly very dark. And, you know, we're chatting, and we were in Dennis's station wagon, his family's station wagon. And And we're driving down this House Rock Valley Road. I'm sure you've been on it many times, you know, it's just a road across the plateau there, and it had been raining. And so there were, you know, a number of ruts. But fortunately, the rain had been a few days prior, so the ruts were just sitting there, and they were fairly solid, right? And the ridges between the ruts were fairly solid. And we're, Larry and I are watching Dennis driving in the dark, you know, with the headlights shooting across through the sage, through the darkness. And we're both kind of looking at each other because it looks like Dennis is driving in the ruts, you know, of the road, as opposed to up on the high points, the berms between the ruts. And so we both kind of looked at each other and then just blurted out to Dennis, you know, man, you got to get out of the ruts. I don't know why this story sticks with me, but it was just a very funny experience, right? And I guess partly for me, Dennis was, you know, he was a much better rock climber than I was. And but he didn't know too much, I guess, about driving these desert roads.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it, you know, it was, we all got a good laugh out of it for sure once Dennis realized that he should be up on top rather than dragging his undercarriage across the
putting
ridges,
the oil
you know,
pan
so,
in the rocks there,
Anyways, so we camped at the end of the road there, where you, as far as you could get in then, it was farther than today. And
So this is the Saddle Mountain
trailhead.
And at that time, did the road go up actually to the saddle?
No, no. It just went up about to about a kilometer, maybe 1.5 kilometers above the descent into Saddle Canyon itself. So you still had several miles of walking up to the saddle. But then we put a, you know, we just laid our bags down for the night, and it was kind of stormy. I know that. And the next morning, Bruce came driving in from Flagstaff, right? So he meets us, and there was snow spitting around as it tends to do at that time of year. And we all stashed the two cars, and then we put our gear together for the trek up to the saddle. And you know, we had to carry snowshoes or use snowshoes on this because there was like 3 feet of snow up on the saddle. And it was a fair amount of work with heavy packs to get up there. And you know, it's a straightforward route because it's just a gradual climb up through the Ponderosa forest there. Beautiful area. So when we got to the saddle, of course, there the snow more or less didn't disappear, but it really greatly reduced because you got the warm air coming out of the canyon, which melts a lot of it. And then, of course, you're facing to the south on an Ankweep Trail.
Right.
So, you know, it burns the snow off. But it was snowing all you know, on and off while we're doing this. And so we stashed our snowshoes at the saddle there. And then started down the trail, and you know, the trail back then was in pretty good shape, but it wasn't as clean and straightforward as it is today. It was easily followable. But I remember because the weather was so bad and the shale slopes were so soaked with you know, the snow and the moisture from the snow, that we actually belayed around that one dicey spot in the trail.
Oh, wow.
And it's hard to believe that, you know, we would need a rope to do that, a belay there, because, you know, I've traversed across there countless times, and it's just a tennis shoe romp. I mean, there's nothing to it, right?
When it's dry.
When it's dry, that's right. And you know, we had these huge loads, and you know, the thinking was if anybody puts their foot down on some mud that is not very well anchored, they could easily slide and go down.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So we set up a belay for that, and then continued around Marion Point there, and the snow was really coming down, and it turns out it was kind of late in the day by this time, and we found this beautiful overhang on the north side of the bay that's just north of Marion Point. just a few yards above the trail. And it was like, I don't know, like 3.5 feet tall, something like that. And, you know, maybe 6 feet deep and maybe 40 feet long.
Wow.
And we each, you know, we found this spot because it was snowing pretty heavily.
Mm-hmm.
We found this spot and said, well, let's bed down here for the night. And we, you know, we laid down our tarps, our ground cloths, and used our mattresses, whatever we had then. I'm not sure that the Therm-a-Rests were invented then, but you know, we would have put something down, and then we each set up our own little our station for the night. And it snowed so much that night that we decided the next day to just hang out under the overhang. And it was just beautiful. And we had a couple of cheesy paperbacks that we passed back and forth, and people were just chatting, you know. And with a group of four, you can get a strike up a good conversation, right?
Mm.
So, yeah. So we spent the day there, and then the next day the storm finally cleared, and so we were able to start down the trail then. And you know, of course, it rapidly melts, and you're going down quite rapidly too on the Nanqueep Trail. So we just continued down to Nanqueep Creek there, and then where there was no snow, of course.
Right.
So. And then my recollection is we hiked from there down to the river and then down Nanqueep Canyon and then walked the river bank down to Malgosa.
Okay.
And Bruce and Larry had come down Malgosa on a backpacking trip. Well, they had actually climbed Malgosa Creek, Crest.
Okay.
I guess it was the year before. And they had invited me on that climb, but I had agreed to take my uncle from Dallas on a trip down into Nanqueep Basin just so he could experience the canyon. So we actually, my uncle John and I, ran into Bruce and Larry coming back from Malgosa.
Oh, cool.
After they'd done the first ascent. Yeah, we ran into them around Marion Point on the Nanqueep Trail. But in any event, they had been down Malgosa Canyon and knew that there was a route, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, many people do this nowadays, but at that time we just didn't have that kind of info, right?
Right.
It wasn't in Butchart, and so it was new data, and but they did say it was really dicey, and which was kind of ironic, but we figured it wouldn't be a problem for the four of us, so we went down the river to Malgosa, and then filled up with water, and then started up, and it turns out that the tight spot in Malgosa that they recall was just a lark, right? It was kind of like that Nanqueep Trail, little shale slope. When the day they went down it, you know, the year before, it was really wet and dicey and with potential for big slides. But when we came up it on this particular time, there was no problem whatsoever, and people just romped up it. And I remember them thinking, you know, they built us up for this, and then nothing materialized. So we gave them some good ribbing for that. But anyway, so this is like what, day three now, and we set up our camp then at where the red wall basically is exposed in Malgosa Creek, and you have a really good view of the north face of Quaggan from there, and on the fourth day of the trip, we headed up, and you can climb straight up from where we camped up to through the Supai to the Esplanade Sandstone, the very top of the Supai. And, of course, you're there on a bench looking at the southeast face of Quaggan, and it looks quite impressive, right? And, well, you've been up it, so you know it's quite spectacular, and we didn't quite know, you know, how to tackle it, but I recall that we were able to pick out a pretty good route, you know, which I can still see on photographs or when I'm down there with binoculars, you know, you can see it. And so we, you know, the first day we actually worked our way up through the Coconino. It was about three pitches, I believe. And I have in my notes there was a 5.8 boulder move right at the base to get you onto the Coconino. And then, you know, lots of third class or easy fourth class scrambling through the Coconino, nothing really substantial. And then up there's an open terrace, and you have to climb up over a little torweep ledge at one point, and that gets you onto onto basically the bottom of the Kaibab, and you recall from your ascent, no doubt, there's a big ledge that you can walk along the base of the Kaibab, and this took us, you know, walking south on this ledge took us to the crack system we'd picked out, and there's a big overhang at the base of the crack system, starting off this Kaibab ledge. And Dennis led that, I remember, and I think we rated that 5.8. And then he led up that crack, and we did a couple of pitches that day. I think I led the second pitch, and again, in the notes, it's 5.4, 5.5, not, mm-hmm. you know, not too difficult. And at that point, we pretty much had to beat it because it was getting late, so... Mm-hmm. And we were camped basically at the down on the red wall, right? So we had to get way down to our supplies, and so we wrapped the route at that point, left a rope in place, or two ropes actually, one for the Kaibab, and then one for the tricky part in the Coconino, and then went down to our camp. And so you know, the next morning we worked our way back up and. Worked up the ropes. It was quicker, and I think around we were back climbing by about 10:30 in the morning, and the climbing was, you know, challenging enough for us, enjoyable. We put in a couple of bolts, I recall that. We didn't want to do that, but there are certain places where you just, you know, safety requires it. And Dennis led a really strenuous overhang there on about the third pitch, I think. Well, third pitch in the Kaibab. And then that took us up to basically a ledge at the very top of the Kaibab, which you could traverse south for about 40 feet and get into a nice little open book corner. And I got to lead that pitch. That was the last one up to the summit. So it was... that was nice, like about a 5.7 or 5.8 layback corner. Lots of fun, and you know, very exciting to get to the top of this climb, because we none of us had done anything like this in the canyon before.
Oh wow!
And I'd done some, you know, grade fours in Yosemite with my friend Scott Kronberg, and another one with Chris, my friend Chris Beal, and Doug Rickard. In the mid-70s, and, you know, those were overnights where you're bivouacking on the wall and whatnot. But we'd never done that in the canyon, right? It was mm-hmm. a big deal for us. And yeah, it was very exciting and very satisfying. And of course, we got to the top, and we walked around, and we find the Bradford Washburn junk, and, you know, from the surveying projects right. that he was working on. And I have it in my notes that we gleefully pushed all that stuff off the north face. So another thing you probably shouldn't tell the Park Service, right?
Right.
And
right.
But you know, it was kind of for our mind, from our perspective, it was just trash that mm. had been left behind.
Mm.
And so we pushed that off, and then we made our own giant cairn, and that was it. Then, you know, we retreated and. Wrapped the route and got back down to our camp there. And then the next day, I think, was our return to the cars, although we probably didn't get all the way out. I think it took us 2 days, and we were moving kind of slow. So, yeah, it was a great trip. And, you know, with Dennis, it's the only time I ever climbed with him, and he was really, you know, a solid climber on that stuff. And I think that if it had just been myself and Bruce, we might not have made it up, you know, because of the overall difficulty of the climbing. So it's hard
cool.
to say, you know, but certainly having Dennis there, it really benefited the party. So
nice.
Yeah, probably my you know, one of my most one of the summits I'm most proud to have climbed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in my career. So certainly one of the biggest that's in the canyon. So, and I think people now free it at 5.10. It's done without, we did a point of aid at one place that Dennis used, and we rated it 5.882, I think, based on that basis. And now it's done free. Well, you've probably done it free, right?
No.
No,
we had at least two pitches, but I think the route may have changed a little bit since you guys pioneered it to something a little easier.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because I you know, your description, and I'm thinking, I don't remember that at all, but of course my memory is not that good. So, you know, it's like, but it was a very enjoyable climb.
Yeah.
It sort of laid back, the whole cliff is sort of laid back a little bit. So you're not like straight up and down. You're kind of just, you're in the monocline where the bedding planes are starting to dip up a little bit. So it was really enjoyable. It's, you know, good group of people and you know, just, it was a fun day.
Well, I think your experience also, I mean, it may be that the route has changed. You know, big chunks fall off these walls, and so things can change significantly. Look what happened on Zoroaster, you know, 10 years ago. Yeah, so it's possible. But, you know, another possibility is that it's just differences in route finding ability. And you know, like we've talked about lots of these climbs like Horace and Raw and whatnot, where, you know, different parties have found different routes up.
And
so it's possible that, you know, other parties going up Quaggan would pick out a different line. But I do recall that, you know, the lines are limited on Quaggan. So, it's just a question of how you're feeling on any particular day.
Yeah.
So,
that's right.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to lead anything. It just followed along. It makes a difference too, you know. If you're leading, it's a different climb than if you're following, cleaning up.
Yeah,
after
that's for
else.
Sure.
So, yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So that was like my last big climb, you know, before I went to graduate school, and I had no idea how graduate school was going to impact my life. And you know, I mentioned earlier when I was living in Tucson and going to U of A, you know, I would do my studies and there would always be time on weekends for climbing trips or even in the afternoon after classes, you know, we'd go out to the Campbell Cliff and go bouldering out there and on the north side of town and spring break, you know, you'd always take a long trip somewhere. But once I went to graduate school, all that kind of changed because it was a different level of pressure. And you know, you want to perform well. I mean, I did anyways in graduate school. And I mean, all the other students I was in there with, you know, were similarly motivated. Nobody's there to slack off. And it's a tremendous time, of course, to learn things and about your science and whatnot. So, you know, I have to say that with the best of intentions, I went to California, you know, I was going to hone my rock climbing skills at Talkeets and Lover's Leap and in Yosemite, but I rarely went to these places because I was spending my weekends, you know, preparing lectures for the undergraduates that I had to meet on Monday, or, you know, putting together proposals for, you know, field programs for my own research projects. I mean, there's just millions of things that come up that take up your time.
What did you do your master's in? Where did you go to school in California? What did you do your master's in?
Yeah, okay. Well, I went to school at Davis, California. So it's University of California at Davis. And Davis is the original agricultural college for the University of California system. So it's about 15 miles west of Sacramento,
okay,
which is the capital of California. And so in the middle of the the Great Valley of California. Mm-hmm. There's the big central depression or trough in California between the Sierra Nevada and the coast ranges is the Great Valley, and the north end of that's called the Sacramento Valley, and the south end of that's called the San Joaquin Valley, and Sacramento kind of sits between them, right? And Davis is on terrace farmland that's west of Sacramento, and they're surrounded by agriculture.
Okay.
And it was a great place to go to graduate school. Very quiet community of about 30,000 people, most of them affiliated with the university. And you know, I just had a wonderful experience there. But again, not too many opportunities to go climbing. Not. I don't want you to think that I didn't do anything. But it wasn't to the same par, you know, that I was climbing or hiking when I was
I would
Tucson.
assume
So.
that if you wanted to go climbing, the granites of Yosemite were just an hour away, hour and a half away?
Well, a little bit more than that. I mean, Yosemite
Okay.
was like 4 hours, and
4 hours,
then
all
but there
right.
was a place called it's Lover's Leap, which is up on the highway from Sacramento to Lake Tahoe.
Okay.
And that's another large granite buttress that's has a lot of really good climbing on it. And there's also a few smaller buttresses on the order of 300 feet high, 400 feet high, which you encounter as you're driving up through the Sierra Nevada foothills up to the crest of the Sierra. And that's where this Lover's Leap is. And so there were places to go. It was still an hour and a half to 2 hours drive to get to that good granite.
Wow.
And of course I mean, quite honestly, I spent most of my time climbing on buildings,
Oh.
and just bouldering on the campus to try and
Okay.
stay in shape because it
Right.
was so far to get to.
Yeah.
You couldn't just hop on in your Volkswagen and drive 15 minutes and then be scrambling on on nice bouldering rocks
Right.
in Sacramento. So,
What did you get your master's in?
yeah, I got my master's again in geology with an interest in paleontology.
Okay.
And so, I
Was
don't know how much you want to
that
go into
a
this.
well, yeah, did you have to do a term paper? What sort of what did you have to do to fulfill your master's degree?
Oh, well, it was very cool. So, I knew that I wanted to use fossils to solve geological problems. So I got my undergraduate degree at Tucson in geology, but I had this interest in a particular group of fossils called ammonites, which are related to octopus, but they have a hard shell. And they are extinct now. They went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period, about 65 million years ago. But while they were in the oceans, they experienced a tremendous amount of evolutionary diversification. And they didn't. Each individual species didn't last that long in geological time, a few hundred thousand years, maybe 1 million years. And so
Wow.
when you find the fossil shells, they're very useful and diagnostic as time indicators. And I don't want to spend too much time in this, but there's some great books about this science if you're interested in pursuing it. The Map That Changed the World about the British canal maker named William Smith, who was also a he used fossils part time to help him produce the first geological map that anybody had made anywhere, and it was of the British Isles. And
Right, and
anyways,
he was a lowly surveyor, wasn't he? And he,
yeah,
I mean, they wouldn't let him into the Royal Society of Geologists or whatever it was, and
that's right. Yeah, he
it's
was
quite the
well. He
story.
started out as a surveyor, and then he became a canal engineer, right?
Yeah.
And as he dug these canals across England, he would find the fossils in the rocks that he was excavating, and he would note that, from the dip of the beds, from the dip of the rocks, he would note that certain fossils were at the bottom of the rock sequence, and so therefore they're older. And then other fossils would always be found at the top of the rock sequence, and they were therefore younger. And he was able to recognize these same relationships all over England, wherever he went. The older fossils would always be found at the bottom of the rock sequence, and the younger fossils would always be found at the top. And of course, there were lots of other fossils in between, so he was able to recognize different layers based on their fossil content.
Right.
And which were deposited at different times successively during geological time, right? And very insightful piece of work for science. And he extrapolated that across the English Channel, and he found the same successions of fossils and rocks in the Paris Basin, which occupies about the northern half of France. So he made these incredible scientific observations, but because he was just an engineer and a canal builder, the Royal Society, they turned their nose up at him and they wouldn't let him come in. They wouldn't let him in as a member. And so he had to scramble to find private funding to pr prepare these geological maps, and it was not straightforward, you know, because these were big maps, big endeavor to produce these geological maps. And but he did find some private benefactors who gave him just enough to get these maps produced. And even then, you know, he was not accepted into the Royal Society. I don't think ever. And but posthumously, he was recognized as a major contributor to the science. And you know, he died pretty much penniless. And but you know, he left a scientific legacy that people like me just think is tremendous, right? So, yeah, I really recommend that book by Simon Winchester, I think it is the author. It's called the, The Map That Changed the World.
Yeah, it's a good read. So,
yeah.
So were you working? Did you get a scholarship to go UC Davis, or were you trying to work your way through? How were you doing that?
Yeah, so, I got a scholarship, which covered part of my fees. It covered all my fees, right? It covered the out-of-state tuition and the registration for classes and things like that. But it didn't give me, like, food and apartment money.
Right.
That, you know, so that – but what I got from the university was a teaching assistantship.
Oh,
TA,
great.
We call
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
and so that paid us – I don't remember what it was, $12,000 a year or something like that. You know, plenty of money at the time.
Right.
To cover rent and food and miscellaneous experiences.
But that also gobbled up a ton of your time.
Oh, yeah. You mean the teaching?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that took up pretty much all my time and then some. And you know, I was doing a project. It's kind of ironic. My professor at the time, who is now at Seattle, University of Washington, Seattle, he had spent some time in Canada working on his PhD, and he knew the geologists up here, and he knew the geology, and so, you know, he suggested to me that I would potentially could do this project looking at rocks and fossils on the north end of Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
Huh.
Well, I had never been to Vancouver Island, which is a big island, kind of California size, off the main coast of British Columbia there on the Pacific margin. And I started researching this area and these rocks, and I thought, oh, man, I'm going to go to Canada, you know, and the land of the lumberjacks and magnificent wilderness. It's going to be just this tremendous experience, and I had it really, really psyched up in my mind, you know. But after about 3 months of planning, Peter, my professor, spoke on the phone with his with one of the people, one of the geologists who had advised him in his PhD work, who was essentially the Cretaceous expert for Canada on these fossils and these rocks. His name was George Gillespie. And he was a Russian that had come over and joined the Geological Survey of Canada after World War II. And anyways, Gillespie said, no, you can't have your student work on those rocks because I'm working on them.
Oh, wow.
Which was kind of a blow when I found out about it, because I was so disappointed, you know, that I wouldn't be able to go to Canada after all and spend all this time up in the remote bush. But just as an aside on this story, I eventually, of course, came to Canada, right? And I worked with George Gillespie for a few years in Ottawa as his protege. I took over from him, and I eventually assumed his duties after he passed away. And eventually I was able to go visit these rocks myself. And I have to tell you, it's an industrial wasteland because they've had all this industrial scale logging in the area.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's a beautiful setting because you're on the coastal reaches of the island there, but the forests have just been destroyed. And, and it turns out the geology and the paleontology was just really kind of scrappy. It would have been a total disappointment as a master's project. So, you know, In retrospect, it turned out very well because I wound up doing a project in California that had world-class geological problems.
Cool.
And and paleontological problems. And I made some really significant contributions scientifically out of that project, right? So, and that was just in my backyard. It was like 3 hours away from Sacramento, from
nice.
Davis. And
nice.
Yeah. So
and
that's what
did
I spent
you roll
my time
that,
doing.
Did you roll that then into a PhD? How did that
yeah,
come
that's
to pass?
Right. Yeah, I started the project, and my first field season then would have been in the summer of 80. And it was up in the foothills of the Mount Shasta area in the Cascade foothills,
okay.
Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, and just beautiful wilderness. It has been designated wilderness now.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't at the time. It was just a national forest land, but it was hotter than blazes, just like, you know, just like southern Arizona in the summer, because you're down there at low elevation in on the margin of the Sacramento Valley, and it's just this god awful hot, dry summer heat. And of course, but the beauty of it is that you have these canyons coming down that have cut down through the tertiary lavas that have accumulated off these volcanoes like Shasta and Lassen,
right?
And these streams bring down, you know, water from the glaciers up on the volcanoes, so they're, you know, they're ice cold, and you've got this contrast with this hellacious hot landscape, very you know, sere with dry grass and digger pines, and then you have these beautiful lush drainage waterways coursing with you know, crystal clear water, and then of course beautiful fossils and geology to be found there. So, but it was very much a wilderness setting, and I got into it like crazy. I mean, it was just like fantastic to be able to go, you know, do all this hiking just as part of my my master's project. And so it was a wonderful experience, and eventually, as I mentioned, I did 2 years, 2.5 years, and I said I want to do more. I wanted to get a PhD, and they said, okay, you can basically expand on the project that you've been doing if you want to do that.
Oh, wow.
You're gonna have to take the exams and everything else, and so they let me do that, but I had to write the thesis for the master's because they said you might flunk out on your PhD, right?
Okay.
So we're gonna at least we're gonna make sure you get your master's first, and then you can go ahead and do the PhD. So yeah, I mean, it was basically writing a fairly comprehensive report. You know, my master's I think was like 100 pages, something like that.
Okay.
But it was mostly just describing these fossils that I found.
Okay.
Several new species, and then of course putting together the geologic framework that the fossils revealed to me about the, you know, the deposition of sedimentary rocks in that part of the world during the late Cretaceous time. Yeah,
and that's a major subduction center, isn't it? I mean, the Pacific plate
and the North American
plate are kind of grinding past each other.
The subduction was actually happening to the west with the Pacific plate pushing against the North American plate, and so, you know, right adjacent to the zone of subduction, you tend to get what's called an accretionary wedge of sediments, deep water, deep ocean sediments that pile up, and they're constant because they're being pushed. So the sediments are coming from the continent, right? Being eroded from the continent, being deposited in the trench that's associated with the subduction zone.
Right.
And then, of course, the oceanic plate is pushing against the North American plate, and it's creating all this pressure. So it pushes these sediments up into very deformed wedges and accumulations that are very unstable. This happens over, we're talking about periods, you know, over millions of years,
yeah,
hundreds
sure.
of thousands and millions of years. And then eastward or landward of the subduction zone is where you have the big central valley of California, and that's called the Four Arc Basin because it's in front of the volcanic arc that existed in California at the time.
Hmm.
We're talking, you know, 80 million years ago, and at that time, and you didn't have granites exposed at the surface like you have today. You had volcanoes, and the granites were the deep roots of these volcanoes. So the volcanoes were erupting and sending ash to the east, and then there was a big trough to the west of the volcanoes, which is the area of today's Central Valley,
okay.
Great Valley of California. And then the subduction zone was just to the west of that. So the subduction zone would have paralleled the modern coastline, and the accretionary melange deposits are the coast mountains.
Okay.
If you know that geomorphology of California.
Yeah, a little bit.
So,
yeah.
So I got to play around in these beautiful four-arc basin sediments, which are shallow marine. They were like 80 to 60 million years old, or 70 million years old. And they had all these beautiful animals that had been, were living there at the time and had been preserved as fossils. And it was my wonderful, delightful experience to be able to collect all this stuff and put together the geological framework for it all. So,
cool.
It was very much an exploration type project, just like the climbing was, because in some of these canyons, the geologists had never even been there. Not one geologist had been there. And so it was like a total revelation to me and to the scientific community, but me primarily, because I'm the one down there to find this stuff. Yeah.
So was that a 5-year program then, 4 to 5 years to go ahead and complete
your
PhD? Yeah,
all told it was 5 years. And yeah, I went there in fall of 79, and then I graduated in the fall of 84.
Okay.
And so in 84, I by that time when I graduated, I had got a fellowship with the Geological Survey of Canada in Ottawa, a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship, they call it.
Okay.
And so that was my next destination, was to drive to Ottawa and straight from California and take up life there. And I just expected to be there for a couple of years. I didn't expect I'd make a lifetime career out of it. But that's, life sometimes takes you in unexpected directions. And, So the whole time in Davis took up 5 years. So
did you?
And there were some canyon trips.
I was going to say, did you get a chance to go back to the Grand Canyon during that 5-year period?
Yeah, there were some canyon trips. There was the trip to Molly's Nipple that I mentioned to you earlier at some point.
Yeah, go through that. When was it?
Yeah,
when
okay.
Happened?
Well, Molly's Nipple was another great trip. This one was solo, and as we've talked about in the past, I kind of have a list of summits that I didn't know anything about whether anybody had climbed them or not,
mm-hmm.
right? And so slowly we're ticking some of those off, like Quaggent and Char and whatnot. But Molly's was one I didn't know. I couldn't find out any information about it. And of course, Molly's Nipples, as you know, is out to the west, Parashant area, and I didn't really spend much time out that part of the park.
Okay.
And because I wasn't a river runner, I wasn't accessing the park via the river route.
Right.
I wasn't accessing those areas of Grand Canyon via the river route. So, it was a fairly unknown area for me. But of course it's on the map, and everybody, you could see it there on the map, and
right.
And there were, routes to get out there, roads and whatnot. It was just a question of putting it together. And so I decided I was going to give it a shot one in March of 81.
Okay.
And so this would have been a couple of years after I had arrived at Davis. And I would try and, I would try and take some time off during the academic year and visit my family in Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
So from Davis, you could hop in. I had a Karma Ghia, and I would hop in the Karma Ghia, and I could drive. My favorite way to go was to go up and over the Sierra at Lake Tahoe,
mm-hmm.
and then go down the east side of the Sierra to Bishop.
Bishop.
And then from Bishop, you can take this little tiny winding road over the
the whites. Is that right?
The White Inyos.
Right. Yeah, the White Inyos.
Yeah, and then into down into Nevada, and then south into Vegas.
Right.
Well, it was north of Death Valley.
North of Death Valley.
Yeah, and then down
right.
to
yeah.
Vegas, and then down to Phoenix. Right? So I would try and do a trip like that to visit my folks once or twice a year, my family in Phoenix, and also maybe do some canyon hiking. Right. So, anyways, I'd planned in this March to try and get into Tamale's Nipple, and I really didn't know much about it except that the maps were published then, and I don't even think that at that time there was a 1:62,500 map for that quadrangle. We were using the big, quarter million scale maps or something?
Try to get in there with the Karman gear?
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't drive into Molly's Nipple. I drove along, I drove across the plateau.
I mean, no matter how you want to get in there with a low slung car like that, I mean, just even the bladed roads would be a challenge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was somewhat of an epic, as I'll tell you here, for sure. But, I had this Karma Ghia I bought it used, which was good
mm-hmm.
because it
mm-hmm.
had a little bit of rust on it when I bought it. It came from Maine. I bought it in Phoenix. It was a soft top, and I had that car for about 10 years. And I put like 300,000 miles on it,
wow.
rebuilt the engine twice. I moved to California pulling a U-Haul trailer with this Karman Ghia.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons that's one of the times I had to rebuild the engine. But it just, I went everywhere with this car. And I remember the first time I took it up, I went to the South Rim with my friend Fred Keenan, from Tucson, and this was a big deal for us because it was 76 and we did it on a weekend. This is the first time I'd ever done a weekend trip from
wow.
Tucson to the Grand Canyon and back. I think it was like a 4-day trip, but we went and climbed Pollock's Temple off Jicarilla Point.
Yep.
And so I had to drive that boundary road.
Oh my gosh.
In the Karma Ghia, and
yep.
it was quite dicey because it's all rocks everywhere, it was a real challenge. But it was like I bought this car to take me places, and it just served me wonderfully. You'd get into these these tracks across the Kaibab Plateau, and you can go for miles, if you just be very careful, trying to keep that car on top of the high centers, and so you don't grind out the bottom. And I ground out the bottom many, many times, right? So it's just, it was meant to be utilized, and, had a lot of memories with that car, but it had a lot of dents.
So to get out to Molly's, you've got to go, let's see, you were coming from UC Davis, so you would have come in through Kanab, and then, headed south, down toward
Torrey? That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Out southeast from Kanab. Well, just west of Fredonia there is
right.
where the road cuts south, and then you drive southeast. Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm thinking of Kanab Canyon. Molly is for Parachon. You're farther west.
Farther west. That's right.
Yeah. So in the St. George area, you're coming south from the.
Wolf Hollow or Wolf Hole, something like that.
That's right, Wolf Hole. That access area there. And unfortunately, I don't have the big map of Arizona, that part of Arizona, up on the wall, so I can't actually refer to
right.
it. But
you go through the little one room schoolhouse on Mount Trumbull.
I don't remember seeing that.
Okay.
I don't remember seeing that.
All right.
But pardon me, I had to take a sip of water there.
Yeah, no worries.
But I remember that, I had the maps. They showed some passable dirt roads,
right.
that looked like they might be passable. You never know till you get there. And I looked like I could drive in to the head of Andrus Canyon,
mm-hmm.
which was a tributary to Parachon, I think. And Molly's nipple sits up on the esplanade on the west side of Upper Parashant Canyon.
Right.
And so I was able to drive in, and the roads were fairly straightforward going in. It had been graded, I guess.
Okay.
And I was able to drive in down into a little valley, I guess, in the starting down into the Kaibab. So it had been incised down a little bit into the plateau, and that's kind of where the road ended. The road went farther, but it was obviously going to deteriorate, right?
Mm.
So I just left my car there in this little valley,
mm.
and then I just started down with my backpack with food for 5 days,
okay.
And it was just straightforward walk. There was the remains of, this excavated, or probably a mining track that somebody had put
right.
in partway down Andrus. So I followed that and made good time down that. And then once you get down onto the esplanade there, there's kind of like horse trail or deer trails and cattle trails that are kind of leading everywhere. And
mm-hmm.
it's just very easy to make time. No,
yeah.
There was the road actually continued. That's right.
Right.
The road continued along the rim. It was very rough though. And I seem to remember there were actually even little surveying stakes in it, like they had, they were just laying it out, or maybe they were going to revitalize it or improve it, because there was exploration for uranium going on in that
area
at the time.
Exactly, that's right, that's right.
Yeah. So anyways, I followed that out there and then got to the base of Molly's, and I remember when I'd climbed Molly's, it was just a beautiful sunny day, one of those perfect days in the spring, and I got to the summit and no cairn, right? So it was like very cool, very cool. And I don't remember being hard at all, just third class, because I did not have
That's
a rope.
Right. That's right.
And went up the west ridge, the west side of
yes.
the summit block, right? So that was very cool to get that, because it was a major, summit, stick, kind of like the Sinala.
Mm-hmm.
And type of summit, which is just out there by itself,
right.
And so I was very happy to get that, so I came back down, and then I went back, worked back north, and then walked down Parashant a ways through the Red Wall, and this is strictly from my memory now, and then up, I think, an arm to the east, and I came back up onto the esplanade there, and I was walking back around, and I actually ran into a crew who were surveying for uranium at the time.
Okay.
So a couple of guys were in there, and I believe that they had helicopter support. I'm not quite sure on that, but I don't think they had a vehicle on the east side of Parashant.
Right.
But
there is a road,
though,
that does come in from the Barten from the Whitmore. In the Whitmore
okay.
area. Yeah.
Okay.
The Frog Springs Road
yeah.
comes around that way.
Yes. Well, see, you know more about the area than I do, because that was really my only foray into the Western Grand Canyon in many, many years.
Okay.
So that's
new country.
Yeah, that was spectacular, and just it kind of opened my eyes, because it was like another part of the Grand Canyon that I had not experienced, with these open vistas up there on the esplanade.
Yeah.
And, most of the discussions we've had have been about the climbing in, Nankweep and Quaggan and Deer Creek and places like that, where you have this tremendous geomorphological variety, 5,000 feet of elevation difference between the bottom and the top. And out on the esplanade there, it's a different story, because all you see is the long distance views across the esplanade, and then you see the Coconino and Kaibab cliffs, traversing off into the distance, and you often don't see the big gash that's in the middle that gives you all your elevation down to the river, right?
Exactly.
So it was a different experience, and I think that my experience there kind of presaged the many, many trips, hiking trips I did with Art Christensen out around Powell Plateau and Great Thumb Mesa. We just spent many, many weeks, actually, hiking out on all those terraces because we enjoyed, you know, walking on that esplanade platform just so much, you know. And, yeah, so that was one really productive and, you know, big trip for me because it kept my interest going, you know, getting that first ascent of Molly's. So, and there was another trip I did about the same time. I think it was, it might have been right after Molly's because it was still 81. It was the spring, and I would have had to get back to grad school. So, what happened was I probably went back. I probably went to Flagstaff after Molly's and stayed with Bruce and Dewart, his girlfriend. And then I said to Bruce, "Look, I know this butte on the east side of Marble Canyon that I don't know anything about. It looks spectacular. We ought to see if we can go climb it. And there's a place called Sazzy Nasket. It's down below President Harding Rapids. So between President Harding and Nanqueep. And so there's this fault ravine that cuts across the river there and drops the Kaibab on the east side of the river down. There's a promontory called Sazzy Nasket, which in Navajo means something like place of loosely stacked rocks or something like that. And there's just off from that and separated by another fault from the rim, there's this monolithic butte that sits there. And it doesn't have a name, but I just called it Sazzy Nasket Butte because it's right next to this feature called Sazzy Nasket. So I said to Bruce, why don't we go try and climb that? See what's out there. And he said, okay, you know, he had a friend of his named Murphy. What was Murphy's? Bill Murphy. Bill was his first name. And Murphy decided to go along, and the three of us drove up there in Murphy's Jeep and worked our way out across the plateau to the end of the road there. And you drop down, and right away we found this beautiful descent ravine off the rim, and it went down very steeply, right, and through the Kaibab and the Coke, all the way down to the bottom of the Coconino, and then there was this fairly impressive step down to get onto the slope below, and so, you know, I mean, by the time we got down to the base of the Coconino, I thought, we've got it in the bag, man. This is simple. And I actually just kind of, you know, third class down this small little move. And then Bruce came down too. My recollection is that Bruce came down too. And, but this fellow Murphy, unfortunately Murphy's passed away now about 5-10 years ago, I guess. But he balked at it, understandably, you know, cause he, if you're not doing this kind of stuff all the time, it can be really intimidating, you know, big exposure and you know, you screw up and it's kind of over. So, so we spent a lot of time there trying to get Murphy down and we finally decided to give up on it. But what I did was while they were trying to, come up with a solution to Murphy's dilemma, I continued down. Well, I was at that point. I was below the Coconino, so I could continue down and to the west. I got to where I got the ridge, and I could see to the northwest that it was a clear shot to get to this butte, right?
Okay.
And so I thought, well, you know, we're not going to make it this time, but we can come back another time and pull off another first ascent, even though it's a non-named summit. So, so we retreated, and then I went back to California. And of course, you know, a lot of these times when I was in Arizona, I didn't have the luxury of being able to stay an extra day to try a second attempt or something like that. So I had to get back, you know, and Bruce wrote me about 2 months later, and he said, "I hope you don't mind So I was back in California, and he wrote me, and he said, a letter, right? Wouldn't it be an email? He wrote me a letter, and he said, I hope you don't mind, but Murphy and I went back and climbed Sazenazcut. So, you know, it was, nice. But if we hadn't done the recon, they wouldn't have, they wouldn't have had the beta, right? So that was fine. I was a little miffed at the time because I was hoping that, you know, we could all go back and do it. I wanted the first ascent. I'll be honest with you. No big deal. I don't hold it against Bruce at all. So, So that happened. That was 86. And then there was another climb in the latter part of 86 where we with Bruce. We climbed.
I'm confused. Yeah? Is that March 81? So this was you did Molly's and then headed back.
Yeah, you're right.
It was
81. I was talking. Yeah, that's you're totally right there. I did Molly's and then right after that I did Sazenazcut. We had tried to do Sazenazcut. Okay.
Yes.
And it wasn't. Yeah, I'm getting mixed. I'm getting ahead of myself here, because there was so many gaps in my travels back to Arizona. You know, long periods when I didn't do anything. So, the next thing of any consequence I did was probably that Confluence Butte, which would have been in 86 with Bruce. So,
okay. You know what?
And there's a great story about that if you want to go into it now, but.
I do, but not now, because we've been going for about an hour. And it's probably a good time to stop here, and then we'll pick it up, our Confluence Butte, in 1986.
Okay.
We'll
All right, that sounds good.
Cool.
All right, excellent.
Anything else you want to add to this section that while you're thinking about it?
Well, there's, you know, one thing I did it crossed my mind here while I was rattling on about. I mentioned I climbed Pollux with my friend Fred Keenan,
right?
And we did that in a long weekend from Tucson with my Carmen Ghia, right? And one of the things that was so bizarre on that trip was we drove up from Tucson and we got to Jicarilla Point late in the night, like at midnight or something like that. Mm. And camped there, and in the middle, we were like right on the rim, you know, just sleeping on our ground claws. And in the middle of the night, we hear this rumble, and you know what is going on. And we both got up and we watched as from the north, this lights, several lights. It wasn't actually not even lights. It was kind of. Illuminated by the moon, but it was like a black wedge of darkness was moving in our direction, and I swear to God, it went right over us at who knows what elevation, and fairly slow. And I was thinking, Mike, you know, is this some sort of alien creature or a extraterrestrial vehicle? It was just incredible to have this thing go right over us, making this low-pitched rumble.
Huh.
And the only thing we could figure out, it was like some sort of one of these, you know, wedge bombers that the Air Force was working on that, you know, are like radar impenetrable, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what they call them, but I know that they had this big wedge shape to them because that's what it looked like as it went over us, you know.
Huh.
But it wasn't fast. It wasn't moving fast. It was just kind of like... It was just a very weird experience. So that's one of these unusual canyon experiences that sticks with you, you know, and you kind of wonder what it really was, you know. Yeah.
Wow.
But of course, I've never seen anything like that since. I have to say though, every time I see one of these bombers in a picture, I say, well, that's exactly what it, imagine
it like.
That shape, totally blacked out, just kind of. You know, flying above you, but blacking out the stars. And anyways, a very unusual experience there that
cool.
I've never forgotten. So,
curious. Huh.
So yeah, that's I've talked a lot here.
All right.
I'm amazed you put up with this, you know.
No, this is good. I'm looking forward to Confluence Butte in 1986, so this is good. With that, then, this will conclude the Part 7, Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, March 7th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity.